Boy, he specializes in making those. Irving with the mid-range pull-up knocks it down. LeBron with a stroll through the paint and a finish with the left hand. Darren Williams from three. Channing Frye from downtown knocks down a three. Still stone cold.
Oh, there's just the pass right on the money.
James underneath. Somebody said weight room. And he muscled it in and won. Oh, they caught him sleeping, Hubie.
Where are those great long court passes?
George blocked that time. Boy, the Cavaliers really tightening the screws. Kyrie kept it himself and won. George a little bit quiet in this ball game offensively. Just 5 points, but have no fear. Lance Stevenson. Stevenson, he has been hot. Miles from downtown. Stevenson, nice great fake by Lance. Yeah. And one. Trying to come to the rescue. George from downtown. Cashes in. Back in the day, here's Teague from long distance. Teague with the pass. Bucket good by Turner.
Well, here comes a double. See, there's a nice pass.
Great feed inside to Young, and the game is tied. One-on-one here against LeBron. George with the fadeaway. Tipped up and in by Thaddeus Young.
Yeah.
Turner trying to guard LeBron for three in the lead.
Oh,
the king is alive. Oh, and George slipped and the lose possession. They get it back, miraculously. Six to go. Trying to get free. George for the tie. Missed everything. And that punctuates the type of afternoon it's been.
It's just important to play your game. You don't go into the series saying, let's sweep. You go into the series saying, let's win game one. And then game two, you say, let's be better than game one and win game two. Same with three and four. And if it happens to go to five and six and seven, then you got to make adjustments throughout the course of a series. And you don't go in with that aspect. I think every game has different challenges, just like tonight. Tonight was a different challenge than we had, or today, than we had in game three. And we found a way to win. Our guys, everybody who came into the game, followed the game plan. It's close to 48 minutes, and that's the result of it.
Well, at the end of the game, he's been making them. You know, when we need that run or we need that big shot, he's been stepping up and making it. That's what he gets paid to do. That's why he's the best player in the world, and he does it all the time. Tonight, we needed that. We fell behind by two. They went on a good run, and he made a big shot. And when he made that shot, we didn't look back. Defensively, I thought we took a step forward. That's all I wanted to see. I know we can score the basketball. Getting stops is most important, and all these games came down to the wire, and when we needed to get stops, we got stops.
Rough night. No, that's all it is. Just rough night. Nothing that I haven't dealt with this whole series in terms of double team and traps. Just a slow night for me to get a rhythm. You know, it's real frustrating to, continue on losing, to the same team or same person. You know, it's what I work hard for in the summers, to try to help lead a team of my own. And ultimately, this is who I'm going to always have to see and face. But again, came up short. Didn't do enough.
I don't want nobody to try to split us up. We all one team. Regardless, if I go to the bench, if Steven's on the floor, if I'm off the floor, we in this together. Don't split us up. Don't try to split us up. Don't try to make us go against each other, try to make against Russell and the rest of the guys, Russell against Houston. I don't want to hear that. We in this together. We playing as a team, and that's all that matters. That's it. Next question.
Isaiah Thomas is a hell of a player. An unbelievable competitor. He's a warrior. Everything he's going through right now. He had a hell of a game tonight, but when you're allowed to discontinue your dribble on every possession, he is impossible to guard.
I mean, that's not the reason why I'm an impossible cover. I mean, it is what it is. I guess he's going to just keep saying it, but I mean, I've been dribbling that way my whole life.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And what's going on? A great Monday afternoon to you. Thank you so much for joining us right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, we are Toledo's sports leader. It's 13 minutes after 3. By my count, we have an hour and 47 minutes of awesome in front of us. Hope you're having a great day and that you will indeed stick with us. And, in fact, be a part of the conversation. Don't just sit and listen. I mean, we love it if you want to sit and listen, too, because I got plenty to say. But I also love it when you are interactive and you want to have your say as well. That's what we're here for. Phone lines will be open at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. Twitter, you can reach us with comments, and we'll read the good ones on the radio at Sports Radio 106.5, and also Facebook, 106.5, The Ticket. That's right, Sports Radio 106.5 for Twitter and 106.5, The Ticket for Facebook. So we'll get your thoughts on the air one way or the other, even if you can't. Wait on hold. A lot of basketball in that montage. Cavaliers, you've heard of a clean sweep, right? What you just heard or heard some highlights from in the fourth game, that was not a clean sweep. What the Cavaliers did in the first round of the playoffs was a sweep, but it was by no means clean, because the Cavaliers were routinely giving up 60 and 70 point halves, excuse me, to a 7 seed that wasn't even certain it was going to make the playoffs until the final game of the final day or two of the season. A team that's 500 in the regular season. A team, the Indiana Pacers, that quite frankly just isn't that good. I'm not saying they're garbage, but they're not that good, and they're scoring 70 points and a half on the Cavaliers. Really forcing the Cavaliers to go down to the wire to win these four games? It was a sweep, and history will show that LeBron James, that model of first-round consistency that he is, and it really is astounding, he has now won 21 consecutive games in the first round. Since 1984, that is an NBA record. The previous record was held by, and we say 1984 because that's when we have the current playoff format. It wouldn't be fair to say he swept a five-game series. These are seven-game series. But he has broken the record previously held by Magic Johnson, James Worthy, and Michael Cooper, all together, of course, with the Lakers, who had won 20 consecutive first-round games, and Byron Scott with 19. Now LeBron James is at 21, and that will be the number he builds on next first round, next season, when they do this all over again. So a model of consistency for LeBron James, who entered yesterday's game, by the way, tied with Tim Duncan for the most best of seven sweeps in NBA history. That's an amazing statistic as well. 10 times now he has had four-game sweeps in a seven-game series. So that's a new record. LeBron James is now 48-7 all-time in first-round games. That winning percentage, according to Elias Sports Bureau, is .873. And it's the best among more than 300 players to play at least 25 playoff games since the current 16-team format began back in 1984. He's 12-0 in first-round playoff series. Under the current 16-team playoff format, the only players with more first-round series wins without a loss are Robert Horry, who was 16-0, and Derek Fisher, who is 16-0. And I think it could be said very plainly and clearly and obviously, neither one of them were the leaders of their teams that got to 16-0. LeBron, of course, is the leader of every team he's been on to get to 12-0. So much, much respect to LeBron James for his incredible accomplishments. And I neglected on Friday's program to really kind of, you know, give him the props that he was due for the tremendous performance in the comeback win, down 25 at half. We talked a lot about that comeback win, but I didn't really talk about his remarkable numbers. Zero turnovers on his way to 41, 13, and 12. I mean, it really was astounding. So I'm going to give him all of his props that he is due now because, you know, like him or not, and a lot of people don't, and I'm one of them. I'm not a big, huge LeBron James fan other than he's, you know, plays for my favorite team, and therefore I'm a fan. But I don't care whether you like somebody or not. You must pay respect when respect is due, and my goodness, what he is doing and the way he is doing it. His efficiency, his field goal percentage in all of these games has been spectacular. I mean spectacular numbers, especially in his 14th season where he is showing no signs of slowing down. Instead of 32, he looks like he's still 22. It's really an amazing thing. But having said that, this is not, all is not well with the defending NBA champions. Because they have been taken down to the wire consistently now by an Indiana Pacers team that quite frankly has no business taking anybody down to the wire. I mean, there's just no other way to say it. At least they have no business taking the Cavaliers down to the wire. Not the defending champions. And in each of those games, outside of, well, one of them was 117-111, but here's what you have. 109-108 in game one. It took a C.J. Miles miss to guarantee that victory. 117-111 was game two. Game three was the incredible comeback game, 119-114 after they were down 25. And then, of course, yesterday, 106-102. These are all very, very close games that should not be that close. And again, I'm getting real, real tired of seeing teams score 60 or 70 points, you know, on the Cavaliers in a single half, and that's what they did yesterday. 62 points in the first half for Indiana. It's just, you know, that's not the Warriors. If you want to win a championship, that's not going to get it done. That kind of defense is simply not going to get it done. So I have some serious issues with the way they won. You know, if you can ever have issues with a four-game sweep, and you really shouldn't, But if you have to, or if you can, I should say, I have them. I have some issues. I have some concerns. We'll put it that way, some concerns with that four-game sweep. So that's where we are with the Cavaliers. But I want to get away from, and we're going to talk a lot more NBA playoffs as this program goes on. I promise you that. As a matter of fact, our friend Dennis Manloff is going to break things down about the playoffs and talk a little bit of NFL draft, which is coming up Thursday, too. That's amazing that that is just about here. I mean, I really, really, the NFL does an incredible job of staying relevant and in the spotlight for the most part for all of their offseason months. And one of the things they do is they build this draft up to something huge, and it is here coming up on Thursday. So we're going to talk to Manloff about that, too, as well as the NBA. And I've got the Russell Westbrook story. You heard a little bit of the exchange with a reporter in the top of the hour montage. We're going to talk about the Celtics coming back to even up the series with the Bulls at two games apiece, taking full advantage of the Rajon Rondo injury. So we will hit that a little bit as well. We'll talk a little bit about Milwaukee. Are they legit? They're 2-2 against the Raptors. They're 2-2, and they are too young, I think, to get this done. But you know what? They are also very, very talented. Game number 5 is tonight, Milwaukee at Toronto. I am personally rooting for the Bucks. Nothing against We the North, but you know what? I love the Milwaukee story, and I love the Greek Freak, and I would think it would be a phenomenal showdown with LeBron James. Western Conference, of course, we know that the Warriors and Blazers series is essentially over. That game, number 4, is tonight. That'll be a sweep. The Spurs and the Grizzlies, a shocker. After Coach David Fizdale went on his take that for data rant, the Grizzlies have answered the call, and they won both games at home. The series shifts back to San Antonio for tomorrow night's game number 5. That one is 2-2. The Rockets and Thunder, we know what happened. The Rockets won. I'll talk more in-depth about that as we continue. And then the Clippers and Jazz, that series is tied 2 games apiece. And all signs point to the Jazz taking out the 4-seed Clippers. A 5-over-4 matchup there only because Blake Griffin is injured and Utah is getting healthy. Rudy Gobert is back, so this is a big deal. All right, so there's just a little rundown, but I want to get back into or get into something else as we get started this first half hour of the extravaganza. You saw the same thing that I did, clearly, on Saturday if you were watching the Tigers game. And you saw the worst, quite frankly, the worst of baseball. And that, not that it was intentional. Dude, don't get me wrong. Please don't get me wrong and misunderstand my point when I talk about this. But what we saw is, when I say the worst, my greatest fears when it comes to sports, honestly, have nothing to do with football or hockey, the two quote-unquote most violent sports, right? My greatest fears in sports when it comes to the safety of the players, and I will admit this, it's why I wasn't as good of a baseball player as I was football or basketball. Because I stood in the box and knew that that rock, and if you've squeezed a Major League Baseball recently, it's a rock. It's a very perfectly well-rounded rock. That rock might be coming in, not at 95 miles an hour when I was a kid, of course, but fast enough at my face. And I got to tell you, I kind of leaned back a little bit too much. And I would sometimes step in the proverbial bucket, which you teach kids not to do. And what happened to Jacoby Jones of the Tigers on Saturday is the reason why. Jacoby Jones took one off of the face, mind you, not the helmet, the face, inside the ear flap, right in the mouth, the left side of his mouth. It split him open. It required 9 stitches to repair the cut after his lip, and he feels grateful. Grateful, Jacoby Jones is. He feels like he got off easy. He took a 90-mile-an-hour to the heater, or I'm sorry, excuse me, a 90-mile-an-hour heater to the face. Wasn't a curveball that got away. Wasn't a slider. It was the juice. It was 90, and it was right in the face. Let's just give this a listen, and you'll have to imagine, of course, if you have not already seen the video.
Oh, man.
Jesus Christ, you can hear it on the radio call. Actually, this is a television call. I take that back. But you can even hear it over the radio as I play that. Cushlin, Frank, did you hear it?
Wow.
You can hear it. And as you know, there's not like a mic on the umpire. I mean, that's just the general stadium mic, the crowd mic. That's a crowd mic. You know, it's not the microphone from the play-by-play guys who are up in the booth, and the umpire isn't mic'd down there. That's just the, you know, when you hear the cheering and the rustling of the fans and whatnot, you know, that's a crowd mic. And over the crowd mic, you can hear the ball hitting Jacoby Jones in the face. It is the most, one of the most gruesome things that you ever see, and you will ever see. And I'll tell you the rest of the story after we hear it again.
Oh, man. Jones goes down, hit by the pitch. And Jacoby, you can hear it crack off the helmet, and he got it in the face.
Yeah, he did.
That's how loud it was. That's how loud it was. The broadcaster thought it was the helmet that you heard go. Kh-. No, that's his teeth, his jaw, his mouth. That's what you heard. That wasn't the helmet.
Man, oh man! Right in the mouth of Jacoby Jones. Kevin Rand and Doug Teeter out immediately to tend to him.
I'll hold off on the retaliation in a second just to kind of talk more about Jacoby Jones. Guys, feel free to weigh in on this from your point of view. But from my point of view, this is the most fearsome play in sports. Much more than, I don't know, it's fourth and one with the championship on the line and everybody up front is going to be slamming into one. There's nothing in sports to me that is more dangerous than a pitched ball up near the head. I can't think of what other than the freakish, and it was truly a freakish track and field accident that killed a person just a couple of days ago. Did you hear about this one, guys?
No.
Yeah, it was a college meet, I believe. And Wheaton College student. Yeah, it was Wheaton College. Where's Wheaton College?
It's Illinois.
Illinois, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there you go, Mr. Chicago.
I was going to say, that's pretty close.
A 19-year-old freshman at Wheaton College was killed at a track meet in an event he wasn't even a part of. He got hit in the head with the hammer. During the hammer throw event, not a hammer, a carpenter's hammer, of course. I'm talking about the hammer that they throw as part of the field events. Ethan Roser is his name. 19 years old, a freshman transfer student from Cincinnati, so Ohio ties. He was volunteering at the meet, and he was hit by the hammer that went awry at about 4:15 p.m. on Saturday. Wheaton College public safety officials and paramedics from the city of Wheaton responded. He was rushed to the hospital and pronounced dead there. The hammer, if you don't know, it's kind of like a ball on the end of a chain sort of a thing. It's not, it's obviously, it's almost like a shot, but on a chain, as opposed to just being thrown from the shoulder, you know, pushed from the shoulder, shot put. So it's called the hammer throw, and it hit him in the head and killed him. He was just volunteering working the track meet. So, obviously, outside of that kind of really fluky, freaky thing, and that is fluky and freaky, a pitched ball up near the head area, especially when it's a fastball, whether it's an intentionally pitched ball to the head area or one that just gets away, is the most dangerous thing in sports. Can you correct me on that? Is there anything else that you can think of than having a rock, a perfectly well-rounded, solid as a rock sphere fired 90 miles an hour at your head, intentionally or otherwise? Is there a sporting moment that you can think of that is more dangerous?
Not necessarily more dangerous, but maybe equally as dangerous, same sport, the liner that goes right back to the pitcher's head.
Okay, yep, thank you. Thank you.
Fair enough. Kneeling, trying to block a slap shot, a point-blank slap shot. Maybe not as close, but still, I've seen some pretty gruesome shots to the head.
The only, you're talking about for the goalie?
No, for defenseman trying to get on one knee to block the shot from reaching the goalie.
Okay. Again, we talked about this some on Thursday or Friday. I'm not a huge hockey guy. Like I said before, it's kind of a niche sport, and I'm not in that niche. But okay, I'll take that. I'm obviously avoiding the obvious, which is MMA and boxing. You know, I mean, that's the whole idea there is to punch your person in the head and make him unconscious. Okay, make him unable to continue. That I'm talking about team sports where the object isn't to hit somebody in the head. I think this is just about it. And not being a hockey player and having been a baseball player, I feel like I can relate to that a little bit more. But, Jim, you're right. The line drive back up the middle and then the pitch to the head at 90 miles an hour from or more from the pitcher. And sometimes they are intentional, as we know, which we'll get into.
Sure.
Because there is a Boston-Baltimore component to this discussion that we're having as well. But for now, we're talking about Jacoby Jones. In the Tigers-Minnesota game on Saturday, he got drilled in the face. And he instead of laying there, which I can't imagine how he did this, I don't know. There's so many elements to this I can't understand. I can't imagine. I can't process. Number one, I can't process how he got up and sprinted down the third baseline toward the dugout. I mean, obviously, he was looking for help. He was probably in shock. He probably didn't even know what he was doing. He was probably running blindly, just like, oh my God, what just happened? I mean, I would imagine that a doctor might describe him as having been in shock. But, of course, they come to him and tend to him immediately and put a towel and on that face, on his mouth. And they take him to the hospital. And he gets nine stitches in his lower lip or his upper lip? It's in his lip, what he calls his big lip. And what he said after this is over, because the medical care he needed, I just gave you. That's the extent of it. And because of that, he calls himself lucky. He said, my teeth still hurt, but they said, this is a quote, but everything was intact and they were still there. I still have to get a CT scan when I get back to Detroit, he said. Everything feels normal. I can bite down. It's just my lip. My teeth are sore, but other than that, it just feels like I got punched in the face. And then here's the understatement. It could have knocked out all my teeth or struck me square in the eye. I am lucky that it hit me in my big lip and just made it bigger. It's all good.
And of course, we know, Bob, not everyone was so lucky almost every time, especially when it's the batter, like in this case for Jacoby Jones getting hit like this. Every time it happens, I as an Indians fan, always remember the story I was told about Ray Chapman, the only fatality in Major League Baseball history.
Yeah, of
from
course.
Way, way back then before
I'm shocked helmets. That it's only been one, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Now that you think about it, although that's the reason they stopped letting you scuff up the ball so much and all sorts of things like that. And on that one, you're talking about the sound in the clip you played.
Yeah.
The other tag to that Ray Chapman story from 1920 was the shortstop for the Yankees fielded the ball and threw it to first because it bounced so far off of the head of Chapman. He thought it hit the bat.
Right. Right, that's a great point. The idea that these guys can take that and obviously outside of Chapman's case and survive. And it's not just the survival part of this. Again, talking about let's go back to Jacoby Jones here. When I said a moment ago, there's so many things that I just can't understand. One of them is how he was able to just run down the field instead of laying on the ground just like in agony and just kicking your feet and just waiting for somebody to come and help you. I mean, because the shock is just again got to be so
right,
so immediate and so incredible and so powerful. What I don't understand is how anybody who takes a fastball to the face, now I'm talking about one that hits you in the face,
mm-hmm.
not one that glances off the helmet. And that's what the helmets are for. That's shocking enough. And those can hurt, and those can give you a concussion just from a pitch that hits you in the helmet.
Sure. They're coming at 90 after all.
Or more. Or more. A lot of guys' fastballs are 95, 96,
right,
97.
Right, of course.
So he may have gotten lucky with 90. From Justin Haley, right?
Yeah, now that you mentioned it, yeah, 90 might be what
it
was.
But if it hits you in the
face,
what I don't understand, how do you ever get back in the box again and actually be a major league caliber hitter? How are you not, every time a ball is inside or a curveball starts out high and inside, how do you just trust that it's going to move and be over the plate and not just go diving out of the way? I mean, and this, I guess the answer to that question is, this is what makes professional hitters professionals. Amateurs, like me, or you, and virtually everybody listening right now, even if you played maybe at the high school level or the college level in baseball. But amateurs probably can't. They don't have the stomach. They don't have the nerve. They don't have the ability to remain calm. They don't have whatever it takes to stand in there and say, as soon as my lip heals and they clear me to play, put me back in the lineup, Skip, and stand in there and take inside pitches again. I can't process how the human mind and the human, I don't know, the guts, if you will, for lack of a better way of saying it, I don't know how that happens.
Well, I guess this
these
is
guys are simply they're made of something different than normal people are.
I guess that's what part of what makes them, being pros, being major leaguers. The other factor too is maybe sometimes you then do an alteration. Do you remember back in the mid '90s when the Indians had traded Bob? You probably remember this when they traded for Kevin Seitzer, and the first time you saw him, he had that weird extra flap across his face. That's because he took a ball to the jaw once, broke his jaw. And then when he was with Milwaukee at the time a couple years before that, and that's why he wore that extra flap.
And it still wasn't enough for me.
Right.
If I'd have gotten hit in the jaw, you know what I would have wanted? I would have, I'm sorry, and it's going to sound wussy, but I've been called wussy before, and I'll wear it sometimes because it probably is. But I would go full softball. I would go full softball cage. You see in softball, the girls wear face masks.
That's true, yeah.
Football style face masks with their helmets. And that, of course, prevents, what happened to Jacoby Jones yesterday from happening. If I was playing at that level, in fact, if I was playing at any level, quite frankly, right now, I think that's what I would insist on. I don't think they're wussies, the girls. I think they're smarter. I think any pitch that comes inside like that, that's traveling at that kind of speed, whether it's a softball or a baseball, I'm sorry. There's a reason why football evolved from being, leather helmets to plastic helmets, and then it evolved from plastic helmets with a single bar to plastic helmets with multiple bars to plastic helmets with full cages on them because guys were getting hurt badly in their faces. It's why hockey, Frank Argano can speak to this since he's a hockey guy. It's why hockey went from no helmets to requiring helmets to then requiring helmets with, the face shields. Is that what they're called? Face shields?
Yeah, they're not required right now, but
a lot
of players are getting a little bit smarter and saying, you know what, I don't think that'd be the worst thing to have.
I can't imagine not wearing one.
Yeah, I've seen enough hockey games in recent times that so many of them haven't. Even I, at one point, assumed that was the new rule, but thank you for pointing that out. It's technically not.
Yeah, I just assumed it was. Yeah. I thought it was made mandatory, but okay.
And in college, you have to have a full, either a cage or a full visor covering your entire face.
And that I remember from seeing some of the Frozen Four a couple weeks back. Yeah. Even at that level, all the college guys, they're wearing the full face mask cage thing.
Right. And see, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I would want. I mean, I felt like I had to kind of point this out, because quite honestly, it scared me when I saw what happened to Jacoby Jones. It scared me. It brought back those memories of playing the game, playing baseball. And it's, for me, baseball is an extraordinarily dangerous game. And it's so bizarre. I mean, you've got Barnes. And I didn't even get to the other part of the story. The other part of the story, of course, is two innings later. What happened? Well, what would you expect to happen? Retaliation happened. Even though it wasn't necessarily an eye for an eye, it wasn't for lack of effort.
Here's Miguel Sano. Oh, what happened there? He threw it behind Sano. Now Sano is pointing toward Boyd. And look out, McCann and Sano now. Sano threw a punch. He threw a right at McCann.
Yes, he did. And I'm trying to think if something might have happened in this game today, but he just went off immediately, started pointing his finger.
Well, anytime the ball is thrown behind you, you feel like there's intent. But what I'm trying to say is Boyd really has not had a difficult time of getting him out. And McCann, he said, all right, let's do it. He went right back after Sano.
So the bench is emptied, and there was a lot of pushing and shoving, and there wasn't one punch. It was essentially harmless. But Matthew Boyd was ejected for that retaliatory pitch behind Sano. And you know what? Again, credit to Matthew Boyd. You saw where that was, right? How high was that?
Pretty up there.
No, it wasn't. It was
it was low. Yeah, it was lower. It was lower, but fine. Yeah, it was lower.
Credit
but
to Matthew Boyd.
Yes.
You don't throw anywhere up near a guy's head intentionally, whether it's a retaliatory pitch or whatever it is. And boy, did it exactly right. It was butt high. If it would have hit him, it would have hit him in the butt, and that's it. It would have hit him right there on the left cheek, and instead it went behind him because he was able to lean forward a little bit or wiggle his hips forward or whatever the case might be. Miguel Sano was, and that's the way it's supposed to be. Now let's take that and let's add that to the other story of the day. And I know we got to get our time out here. The other story regarding this of the day, and that is the Red Sox and the Orioles. Manny Machado standing in took one right at his head. Fortunately for him, he moved his head out of the way just in the nick of time against the Red Sox. And what did we get? It hit his bat. Actually, it's a strike. But Machado was not impressed by that at all. Did not appreciate that at all. So we almost had twice in one weekend guys getting drilled in the face or the head. So I bring this up again just to kind of talk about how, for me, this is baseball. It's why baseball scares me 1 million times more than playing football ever did. And I played football for years into college. Football is everyone's favorite boogeyman. Oh, it's such a dangerous sport. Oh, you got people retired. By the way, you know how I was saying before about, I don't know how you get back in? How do you get back into the box?
Yeah.
You would expect him to do what a lot of football players have done. I've had my third concussion now. I'm not taking a chance on getting another one. I'm out. I'm leaving millions of dollars on the table. I'm quitting. Who was the rookie from the 49ers we always talk about who quit 2 years ago after his rookie season?
Oh, geez. I know who you're talking about. Blanking, too.
Yeah, that's going to be
a rookie safety. He was a rookie safety. He was a very promising young had a very promising young career. Played 1 year and said, I'm not taking a chance of getting another concussion. I'm out of here. That's it. If I'm Jacoby Jones, I'm like, I'm not taking another chance on getting hit in the face with a pitch. I'm out of here. I can just see guys doing that, but they don't. But football is everyone's favorite boogeyman. Everybody says that's the one.
Chris
Borland,
by the way, is I think who you're thinking of.
Who?
Chris Borland.
Chris Borland. Yes, it was. Thank you. But you understand my point. You know, while football gets all of the bad press, football is leading to concussions and CTE and this and that and the other. I would play football for years before I would stand in and face a major league pitcher. I'd like to say unless I knew what his control was and he could always pink the corners and, you know, never lost one. But even Greg Maddux hit somebody up high once in a while, didn't he?
Suddenly makes me think, good thing Bob Gibson's been retired for quite some time now.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, because these guys would just take aim at the head, and they want to knock you back onto your butt so that you never stand in there comfortably against them and take big cuts against them. So anyway, just a very, very disturbing thing. If you're a Tigers fan and you saw that, I'd be interested in your thoughts. Maybe you don't have to be a Tigers fan. 866-240-1065.
And obviously, it goes without saying, the obvious here for Tigers fans who hadn't heard, Jacoby Jones is on the 10-day DL, obviously, because of that. So he's going to miss a better part of a week. There you go on that. And have you noticed the 10-day thing this year, Bob, that they did?
Yeah, I like it.
I kind of like it, too. And no certain conspiracy theorists out there, nobody's manipulated it yet.
Yeah, you're right, yet. And by the way, not only do I like the 10-day DL that they moved to in baseball, it's something I wish they would institute in the NBA. That'll stop these guys from taking the, my knee hurts, I can't go.
Yes.
If you can't go one day, you got to be put on a 10-day DL. That's the way I think that's
still one of the better ideas to try to fix this rest thing we've been talking about all year.
That's exactly right. All right, considerably less dangerous as sports go is golf, and that's why, my goodness gracious, if you've not yet looked into, the only all-inclusive private country club in Northwest Ohio, Brandywine in Maumee, you don't know what you're missing. People always take all-inclusive vacations to save money, right? You know, because your travel and your lodging and your meals are all included. It's a great way to save money. Well, at Brandywine, you're on a constant all-inclusive vacation. For one low price, you get unlimited golf, unlimited cart, pool, fitness, the social events, including the amazing pool parties. It's the brand-new Brandywine Country Club. It is so refreshing when you've got a private club where there's no surprises. You know what to expect because you're a member. The new Brandywine Country Club, featuring 18 holes of Arthur Hills Design Championship golf, is so much fun. Whether you're a casual golfer or you're a scratch golfer, you're going to find the challenge and the enjoyment in this three par fives on the front nine course with a total yardage of 6639. And you know, one of the best things is you never have to wait for leagues to get out of your way, because there's only one league at Brandywine, yours. You play when you want because you're a member. And also, don't forget about the amazing Champions Bar and Grill restaurant. It reopened last summer. It's now open to the public. The menu is unbelievable. They feature the finest marbled, hand-selected, certified Angus beef, aged a minimum of 21 days. I'm getting hungry just thinking about it. If you are out and about it, mommy, have dinner at Champions. It's phenomenal, and it is open to the public. But here's the deal. If you want to join Brandywine, the all-inclusive private country club in Maumee, call 419-865-2393 and do it by May 31st. If you do it by then, they will waive the initiation fee for you. That's right. Join me on the course. Join us at the club. Let's get together and have some fun. Let's join the all-new, all-inclusive Brandywine Country Club in Maumee. And we're coming right back after this on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed. Excuse me. Indeed. Rolling onward. Boy, oh boy. Fighting through this stupid late, this cold, hot, warm, everything, change of seasons. It's just so
annoying. Yeah, it's there again. And incidentally,
allergies just hit, you know, and then it settles in. The post-nasal drip that comes from the allergies and everything else, the congestion, settles in on my vocal cords. Drives me crazy.
No doubt. And then, you know, you add the going from cold to hot and back again. And just a wonderful example. You just heard me in the weather. Tonight it's going to be 40-something for the low. And 48 hours from now it's going to be 80 degrees. So, I mean,
that's I can't tolerate it. My system just can't handle it. I'm doing my best, but I know I sound scratchy. I'm fighting through a cough, too, so I'm doing my best with it. Anyway, back to I want to go to the phones. I'm going to get back to the NBA. I'm going to give you some thoughts on this Russell Westbrook, Stephen Adams / reporter story in a moment. But I want to talk to Jim in Toledo, who's got some thoughts on what happened to Jacoby Jones, the wild pitches, and the most dangerous moment in sports. To me, it's that head-high fastball. To Jim, it's the line drive right back.
I consider him equal, just for the record.
Okay, fair enough. And for Frank, he's talking about a defenseman getting down and trying to stop a slapper. Hey, Jim, how are you? Go ahead.
I'm pretty good. I just wanted to say first, I'm a first-time caller. But I'll tell you what, your show is my favorite one on the radio.
Oh, that's awesome to hear. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, and what I was going to say is they failed to mention, back in the 60s, Rico Petrocelli, he got hit in the face. And they had a picture of him in Sports Illustrated, and he was never the same player again. And it just, I don't know, I wonder how a professional pitcher can lose a pitch in a guy's head.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm not a professional pitcher, so we can only speak to what we know and what we are. When I played baseball in my younger years, I was all over the place, and even when I was on, if you don't bring your arm down just right, and if you don't snap your wrist just right, it can very easily sail high and to the right. If you're a right-hander, I'm a right-hander. It could very easily sail high and to the right. And even for the best pitchers, I mean, you've seen that. Sometimes they really need that extra juice. If they top out at 94, they feel like they need 95 on this pitch. They throw a little harder, and they sacrifice form just a little bit, and their mechanics are off just a little bit because they're trying to get a little bit extra juice on it, and it just sails on them. And sometimes, you know, it's kind of like slicing a golf ball. It just happens that way.
Well, I've sliced them, but the other thing, if I was a professional, I mean, I see this stuff, I think I would wear the helmet with the guard around my chin at least.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Would you go full mask like I was talking about? You've seen the softball players, how they wear a full the pitcher and the batter, actually, in softball, so they don't get that comebacker, Cushlin. You know, that's why the pitchers wear that mask, too.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Of course, the batters all do it, too, in softball. Do you think it's something that would ever catch on in baseball? Would you do that if you were playing, Jim?
You know, yeah, it just depends, you know, what level I'm at. You know what I mean?
I do. I do know what you mean. But you know what? Even if you're at the highest level, you know, if you're at the professional, I mean, to be honest with you, the higher you go, to me, the more the more protected I'd want to be.
Yeah, you're right about that.
You know, the highest fastball you're going to see at single A, you know, might be an 88. You know, but when you get up to the big leagues, you know, it could be 98. And guess what? It's going to do a lot more damage with that extra few miles an hour. Higher the level, you know, even though they're supposed to be better, accidents still can happen, and I'd be freaked out.
It would probably depend on what they had for my vision. You know what I mean? If because, yes, you know, a batter, he's really got to pay attention to the pitches and that. But, yeah, I just thought about it. You know, every time I see somebody hit like that, then, you know, I always picture back to Rico Petrocelli for the Boston. And that's funny because it's the Boston Red Sox, and then they had an incident.
Yeah, they did with Matt Barnes, who threw, like I said, right up behind the head of Machado, who ducked just in time, and the ball hit his bat, for crying out loud.
Real quick, guys, though, I Jim, I do take issue. It wasn't Rico Petrocelli. You're thinking of Tony Conigliario.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I'm sorry.
No, that's quite all right. I'm thinking Rico Petrocelli. I know that name. That's not the right one, though. Yeah, Tony Conigliario is the player you're thinking of.
Yeah, I'll fess up. When you were talking about it, I was not aware of the incident you were talking about. Conigliario, everybody knew. I did not know about Petrocelli, so obviously that's the one you're talking about.
But he was never the same player.
No, he wasn't. Tony was not.
You're right. And you know who else? You know who else had that happen? Who was never the same player? Was for goodness sakes, Dickie Thon.
Yeah,
that happened. When was that? That was like in the late 80s, maybe, or excuse me, late 70s or early 80s.
They were never the same player.
No, he was partially blinded by that pitch.
Yeah, he was, that Conigliaro, he was a hell of a player. And, it's hard to say, but then again, you know, if a guy like that gets hit and I come to bat, whatever inning, I'm going to be thinking, okay, it might be my turn.
Right, and that's why pitchers pitch inside. They'll knock guys down. You know, they'll pitch high and tight sometimes to knock a guy down, even not necessarily just for that guy, but to send a message to the guy after that and the guy after that. Is he coming inside on me, too? And it makes you a little bit uneasy in the box, and you don't step into your pitches, and that's how they get you.
Yeah, if he threw behind me, I'd say, well, hell, he didn't hit me. I would just say, you know, hey.
But you know what? It's really freaky, especially if it's behind you and high, because what is your instinct when you see a ball coming, you know, an inside pitch? It's to back up. And if it's behind you, you're going to back right up into it. It's so counterintuitive to lean forward in order to miss that, to have that pitch miss you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but the one year I know it was the Padres and maybe the Braves, but I swear to God, I said, okay, he's coming up, and they hit Greg Nettles in the buttocks, and man, that just turned into everything. But yeah, as long as, you know, less like Machado, I could see him getting upset.
Absolutely right. Hey, Jim, I'm glad you called, my friend. Thanks for being a first-time caller. I hope you become a second-time caller sometime soon, okay?
Oh, man, yeah, I got the number now, and I will. And I tell you what, man, I enjoy your radio show of all of them.
Well, that's really, really flattering for you to say, my friend. Thanks so much for the call. I appreciate it. All right, yeah, save that number, by the way. Not just Jim, but everybody. Put it in your smartphone. I tell you that all the time, 866-240-1065. That way you don't have to wait for me to give it out when it's time to call. Here's the Machado play, by the way, for what it's worth. And, again, you have to imagine this. Matt Barnes was ejected for this. Excuse me. He was ejected for this pitch, which was literally right behind the head high, of Manny Machado.
Here's to Machado. Oh, look out. He hit him. And there's your payback right there. There's your payback right there. The ball up and in, it hit Machado. He tried to duck, and he could not avoid getting hit.
Not true.
So there's your payback, although he does take a glance out toward the pitcher's mound, and now Barnes has been tossed out. And now John Farrell is coming out, but there's your payback right there. Machado got drilled. So as it turns out, the Red Sox would not let Machado slide, if you will. He gets hit. And, Manny took it very professionally.
And by the way, he's wrong. The announcer still, to this point, doesn't realize he didn't get actually hit.
One down, Leonard, first base. Oh, that's the one.
Different viewpoint.
That's the one. Everybody's up. Manny looking over to the Red Sox dugout. The Orioles bench is up front.
It hit his bat. It did not hit him. It hit his bat and then ricocheted into his back. That's the irony of the whole thing. But at any rate, this is the purpose pitch. You know, they're talking about in this case, I do not believe that the one that hit Jacoby Jones of the Tigers was intentional. That one got away. You could see it. But they're talking about payback here. So Barnes throwing up and, you know, near the head of Manny Machado. To me, there's just no place for that in baseball. All right, going to get a quick timeout here. Top of the hour Sports Center coming your way. Then we're going to get into some NBA hot and heavy. Not only did the Cavaliers sweep, but how about Russell Westbrook with yet another vintage Westbrook? 35, 14, and 14 in a loss in which he was 4 for 15 in the second half. All of the stats jammed toward the front of the game, and when it's time to be money, there's no money to be found, not with Russell Westbrook. We're going to talk with Maniloff about that, also about reporters and their jobs with respect to these guys, and Fred Hoiberg, coach of the Bulls, says Isaiah Thomas is already tough enough to guard. They got to stop letting him cheat. Is he right? I'll give you my answer to that question, and we'll look for yours as well at 866-240-1065 right here on the...
Kyrie Irving, boy, he specializes in making those. Irving with the mid-range pull-up, knocks it down. LeBron with a stroll through the paint and a finish with the left hand. Darren Williams from three. Channing Frye from downtown, knocks down a three. Still stone cold.
Oh, there's just the pass, right on the money.
James underneath. Somebody said weight room. And he muscled it in and won. Oh, they caught him sleeping, Hubie.
Those
great long court passes. George blocked that time. Boy, the Cavaliers really tightening the screws. Kyrie kept himself and won. George a little bit quiet in this ballgame offensively. Just 5 points, but have no fear. Lance Stevenson. Stevenson, he has been hot. Miles from downtown. Stevenson, great fake by Lance. And won. Trying to come to the rescue. George from downtown. Cashes in. Back in the day, here's Teague from long distance. Teague with the pass. Bucket good by Turner.
Oh, here comes a double. See, there's a nice pass.
Great feed inside to Young, and the game is tied. One-on-one here against LeBron. George with the fadeaway. Tipped up and in by Thaddeus Young.
Yeah.
Turner trying to guard LeBron for three in the lead. The king is alive. Oh, and George slipped, and they'll lose possession. They get it back, miraculously. Six to go. Trying to get free. George for the tie. Missed everything, and that punctuates the type of afternoon it's been.
It's important to play your game. You don't go into the series saying, let's sweep. You go into the series saying, let's win game one. And then game two, you say, let's be better than game one and win game two. Same with three and four. And if it happens to go to five and six and seven, then you got to make adjustments throughout the course of the series. And you don't go in with that aspect. I think every game has different challenges, just like tonight. Tonight was a different challenge than we had, or today, than we had in game three. And we found a way to win. Our guys, everybody who came into the game, followed the game plan. It's close to 48 minutes, and that's the result of it.
Well, at the end of the game, he's been making them. You know, we need that run, or we need that big shot. He's been stepping up and making it. That's what he gets paid to do. That's why he's the best player in the world, and he does it all the time. Tonight, we needed that. We fell behind by two. They went on a good run, and he made a big shot. And when he made that shot, we didn't look back. Defensively, I thought we took a step forward. That's all I wanted to see. I know we can score the basketball. Getting stops is most important, and all these games came down to the wire, and when we needed to get stops, we got stops.
Rough night.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed it is. Thanks for staying with us. It is hour number two of the Extravaganza. 866-240-1065 is the number. 866-240-1065. Hey, guys, don't forget, if your driveway is just atrocious and you need a brand new driveway, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket and Buck Brothers has a chance for you to win one. That's right. It's the ugliest driveway contest. Just head over to our website, 106.5theticket.com, and upload a picture of your ugly driveway. Contest ends May 14th at midnight. Good luck to you from Buck Brothers and ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. All right, time to talk a little NBA basketball and even a little bit about the NFL draft, which comes up this Thursday. Our good friend Dennis Maniloff joins us from the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com, the city of Cleveland in the driver's seat, really, of both of these stories, the defending champion Cavaliers with the sweep, and, of course, the Browns, the atrocious Browns, have the number one pick yet again in the NFL draft on Thursday. D-Man, how you been, my friend?
I've been fine, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
Always a pleasure to have you on, Dennis. I want to talk to you about this series. I also want to talk to you before we're done, though, about Russell Westbrook, Steven Adams, and reporters. And I know you know the story I'm speaking of. As a reporter who's been at many a press conference and asked many a question, I want to get your thoughts on that, as well as Fred Hoiberg and his complaints about Isaiah Thomas. We got a lot of ground to cover. Let's start with the sweep. Dennis, it was a sweep, but I saw one headline today that said it wasn't a clean sweep because it was very, very dirty. It was very, very ugly. Four relatively close games, a couple of them extraordinarily close, surviving only on last-minute, last-ditch shots that went awry for the Pacers. But this is a 500 team, Indiana, a team that really didn't even know was going to be in the postseason until the last day of the regular season. And the Cavaliers swept them, yes, but they did not look good doing it, especially defensively. A 62-point half given up yesterday in the closeout game. Obviously, we knew about Game 3, a 74-point half that they came back from to win. So they continue to struggle, but getting by the skin of their teeth. What's your takeaway from the first-round sweep?
My takeaway, Bob, is this is who the Cavs are. I mean, if you expect them to change, then you're mistaken. This is not the 2016 Cavs or the 15 Cavs. These guys are going to have a bumpy ride wherever they go, wherever it leads, however it ends. They might lose in the next round. They might lose in the conference finals, the finals. However long they go, it's going to be a wild ride. They're not going to be a good defensive team if you're suddenly expecting them to all become good on-ball defenders and communicate incredibly well and switch and do all that stuff for 48 minutes. You're mistaken. But what I've come to do now with these Cavs is just enjoy it for as long as it lasts. I mean, number one, they banked the title last year, so that to me is anything is gravy beyond that in this town. But of course you want to see them win, but I just don't think you can get blood out of a stone with this crew. You just have to enjoy what they're doing. You appreciate the sweep. I will say this, Bob. People weren't saying that Indiana was a pushover 10 days ago when they were rolling into the playoffs on a hot streak. So, you know, all of a sudden now the Indiana's terrible, the East is terrible, blah, blah, blah. I say you just appreciate the Cavs for what they did, specifically LeBron James. Another sweep for LeBron, that's 10 in his career. That's mind-blowing, and it's an NBA record.
Broke the tie with Tim Duncan.
I mean, what LeBron has done is incredible. This series sweep had LeBron's fingerprints all over it. I mean, he was the man. He was the reason why they swept. If he's not playing, they get swept. You know, so that's how important he is. So I'm just enjoying the Cavs for as long as they're alive. And to me, I don't count them out until they have four L's next to their name in one series. That's how I'm going to view these guys.
A caller asked me last week what the big difference is between last year and this year defensively. Why can they suddenly not play defense the way they did play defense a year ago? And I'm not saying they were, one of the greatest defensive teams in history on their way to that championship, but, you know, they didn't have these kinds of, you know, obviously they didn't have this kind of second half that they just endured. What were they, 11 and 15 down the stretch, 23 and 23 in their last 46 games, et cetera. Now into the postseason, the same defensive problems they had during the regular season, Dennis. What's so different? Is Matthew Dellavedova and Timofey Mozgov that, you know, are they that much of difference makers when it comes to the defense? Because that's the only thing really essentially different on this team.
Yeah, usually I start outside and go in when I analyze the defense. This time I'll start in and go out. They don't have the classic rim protector. They really do not have a formidable front line when it comes to defense. LeBron is their best big on-ball defender, but he's not protecting the paint very often when he defends. He's usually chasing a good player on the wing. So, they don't have the rim protection. They don't discourage paint points. They don't discourage guards from scoring in the paint or even dribble penetration and then kick out to a wide-open guy who's open because somebody else had to cover. And then you work your way out, and it's lack of on-ball defenders, really good ones. The fact that they continue to struggle with the pick-and-roll or the high-screen action as to why, I mean, I don't think they're dramatically different than last year, but they are. They have taken a step back defensively. Part of it is probably that they haven't had the same guys on the court day in and day out. You know, that's not an excuse. That's just reality. And part of it is because, you know, they've chosen to rest certain guys at certain times. So you don't get that chemistry. There have been injuries involved. And I think another factor is J.R. Smith, because J.R. Smith played a tremendous, in my opinion, he had a tremendous postseason last year as a defender alone.
Yes, he did. I agree with that.
You add his offense, and it's a bonus almost. This year, he's just not the same player. And, you know, he's had a lot of things that he's dealing with off the court that we can't even imagine in his personal life with his child. So I, for one, I'm never going to criticize J.R. Smith for anything that happens this year. But the fact of the matter is,
even the behind the back pass.
Well, he was pushing it there. I was like, you know what, JR, I vowed I wouldn't criticize you, but maybe I'll have to make an exception on that one. But the bottom line is, I'm not saying one player makes an enormous difference, but JR's defense being what it was last year compared to what he's doing on the court this year, there has been a drop off to the extent where it hurts you, at both ends. And, you know, as a result, you know, that's one of the contributing factors to why this team is not really good defensively.
Milwaukee, Toronto, 2-2. Who would you rather see the Cavaliers face in the next round?
You know what? I mean, that's a good question. I think Kyrie wants the Bucks, and he even said that during the regular season.
Why? Is it because he can't guard Kyle Lowry?
Well, no.
I'm being facetious there. I'm joking.
Yeah, he thought the Bucks were running their mouth a little bit too much about how they were up and coming and all. And that's when, remember, I don't know if you remember, the Cavs went back to back on them and beat them both days. And Kyrie was quoted as saying, you know, we want these guys, presumably in the playoffs. So, the reason I mentioned that right off the top is because, you know, the Cavs need a much better series from Kyrie Irving if they're going to go where they want to go. So I'm thinking maybe the Bucks is a matchup that appeals to Kyrie. As far as, you know, but I don't like the Bucks' length. If I'm the Cavaliers, I'm a little, you know, it makes me nervous. It makes me uncomfortable that to have to defeat their length and their athleticism. The Raptors are a team they're familiar with. You know, they feel like they can handle them. But I think of the two teams, the one that's got the most firepower is the Raptors, because if Lowry gets hot, if he gets back to where he's capable and is consistently good, you match him with DeRozan and a couple of those other guys, and they're a dangerous team offensively as well as a grimy team defensively. So, and I guess when you talk about playoff tested, if I'm the Cavs, I'd rather take on the Bucks, because this group of Bucks would be in foreign territory pretty much in the second round. So you figure your experience advantage would be dramatic if you face the Bucks.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And obviously, you know, they've had that experience against them last year. And by the way, I think the Bucks are right. They are up and coming. They are a young team that is going to be a force to be reckoned with if they keep this team together and Jabari Parker comes back healthy and complements the Freak. I mean, honestly, they are going to be very, very good. But I can also see why that would rub Kyrie the wrong way, saying, hey, we're on the mountaintop right now. Quit talking about you. You don't have, you don't have any reason to talk about us. I don't care what happened in the regular season. You really want us to show you something, we'll show you something. I can understand that too. All right, Dennis, I want to get into the Western Conference because I want to talk to you about basketball and about your job as a reporter, as a journalist. We all know what happened yesterday with Russell Westbrook, but for those who don't, I want to go ahead and play this. It's a minute 30 long, D-Man, so bear with us because I want everybody else to hear the exchange between a reporter who was asking Steven Adams, the 23-year-old big man with the Thunder, who had a very good game yesterday, by the way, asking him a question that Russell Westbrook simply did not want Steven Adams to answer. And the exchange afterwards was very awkward and uncomfortable to listen to, and that's why we're discussing it. Here we go.
Steven, second time in three games, you guys really struggled when Russell went to the bench. You were out there for part of that. What goes on when he goes to the bench? Why is Houston so successful, and do you sense that they sort of get an energy boost just from him going out of the game?
Hold on, Steven. I don't want nobody to try to split us up. We all one team. Regardless, if I go to the bench and Steven's on the floor, if I'm off the floor, we're in this together. Don't split us up. Don't try to split us up. Don't try to make us go against each other. Try to make against Russell and the rest of the guys, Russell against Houston. I don't want to hear that. We in this together. We playing as a team, and that's all that matters. That's it.
Yeah, Russell, I'm not trying to split you up, but twice in three games, you guys have not played well at all when you've gone to the bench.
That's fine.
I'm just trying to figure out what's going on.
Say, Russell, you ain't played well at all. Say, Russell and the team haven't played well. Don't say when Russell goes out, the team don't play well. It don't matter. We in this together.
That may be, Russell, but I asked Steven a question. It's a legitimate
question. Between me and you. Next question.
It's a legitimate question.
Next question.
Next question.
Next question. Next question.
No, I think we'll keep the microphone. I had a question for Steve. I had a question for Steven, and it wasn't answered. And I don't understand. If Steven wants to say, he still hasn't said anything. If he wants to say, I don't want to answer that, fine. But
next question, please.
All right. And they at that point, they pretty much forced the reporter to give up the microphone for the next question. All right, Dennis, I got a three-pronged question for you. The first one is about the reporter. As a reporter yourself, knowing what you know about that series, knowing what you know about the Thunder this season and the way they've played with Russell Westbrook without Russell Westbrook, was there anything out of line whatsoever in the reporter's questions? That's part one.
Technically, no, Bob. You know, and I hate calling out my colleagues, especially guys who are doing that job. You know, I'm not doing it currently, so, but I get it to a degree because I've been there. But that was just, I mean, come on, dude, really? I mean, I don't know the reporter's name, but what do you mean? I asked Steven a question. You know where that went. I mean, it doesn't take much to figure out that Westbrook took it over. Adams is not going to answer that question now that Westbrook has cut him off twice and prevented him from answering it. So you know he's not going to answer it. So what's the stuff at the end? Well, I don't want the microphone taken away from me because I still have a legitimate question for Steven. No, let it go, dude.
What about the original question and the fact then, this is part B, that Westbrook jumped in and essentially told Steven Adams, no, don't talk, I got this, even though the question was for Adams. Was Westbrook in the right there?
No, I'm not saying he was. Technically, he wasn't. But listen, let me just answer
that as a dual part then. You know, first of all, forget about what you said about the end of the reporter's question or the follow-up. The original question to Steven, hey, Steven, what goes on out there when Russell leaves the floor? Talk to us about that. And then Russell jumping in. That two-part, it's kind of like two sides of the same coin there. How do you assess that?
I get that the question needs to be asked, but come on. I mean, what do you expect Steven Adams to say? Even if he's up there by himself and Westbrook's not there to cut him off. What is Steven Adams going to say? You know what? When Westbrook's on the court or off the court, we stink it up. Why do we stink it up? Oh, I don't know. Because Russell Westbrook is not on the court. I mean, it's the same question if you ask, Richard Jefferson, why do the Cavs struggle when LeBron's off the court? What is he supposed to say? So I don't, you know, and again, I know maybe the question needs to be asked. But what do you expect from Steven Adams in that situation? And
to answer that, I would expect him to answer. Not Russell Westbrook to step in like he's his father.
What is
no,
going
no,
to
son,
say?
I'll take this one. I expect Steven answer to put into his words how they feel. He was asked specifically, how do you guys feel, you know, what goes on when he leaves the floor? Do you feel like there's an energy level that just drops, or do you, I would expect them to answer, no, we want to step up to the challenge, or yeah, there is an energy level that drops and we got to find a way to work past. I want his feelings. That's what you're asking an athlete about. You, of course, know this for so many years. You're asking for his feelings on the situation, an honest answer.
Well, okay, Bob, but again, and I'm not defending the fact that Westbrook cut him off, because I'm quite honestly personally tired of Westbrook, and I can't wait till Harden puts him to bed for the series. But, again, I'm sitting here saying, you know, it's a question I suppose you could ask, but what, I mean, realistically, what is Steven Adams going to say? How is he going to answer that? Even if he's
nobody
allowed.
That's why I like the question. I haven't really heard. Have you? I mean, I don't cover the Thunder, neither do you. So maybe we don't read the Oklahoma Daily Oklahoman or whatever it is out there. But truthfully, Dennis, the national story on them is all about Russell and his triple doubles, blah, 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 and how much they struggle when he's not on the court. I haven't heard anybody asking the other guys, hey, Victor Oladipo, tell us, how do you guys communicate out there? Because when Russell is out there, there's very few shots for anybody else. You guys don't really get many opportunities. Even yesterday, Westbrook took 28. Next highest guy, 10. So when he leaves the floor, how do you guys decide what we're running and who's going to get the ball and who's going to get the opportunities? I think those are all very legitimate questions. What goes on when Russell leaves the floor? It's a legitimate basketball question that Westbrook, to me, acted like an ass in not allowing Steven Adams to answer.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with the Westbrook stuff. I mean, well, maybe I wouldn't call him what you just did, but I'm tired of Westbrook's antics on balance. You know, I'm sick and tired of all of the shenanigans that surround him. And I know, you know, the Westbrook lovers will say, oh, he's just a great player, and all he's trying to do is, you know, make sure that nobody breaks his team chemistry or whatever it is. No, to me, in that situation, if I'm Adams and Westbrook cuts me off, I'm going to let Westbrook cut me off as the leader of the team. But I am eventually going to say something, you know, in the course of that, whatever it is, minute there. I'm going to say, hey, you know, I can speak for myself, and what I prefer to do in this case is defer to Russell, because I agree with Russell. At least say something to that effect. And punt the question that way.
You know what I would hope too, Dennis, is that Steven Adams has something to say to Russell Westbrook when they're away from the microphones. Like, hey, you know what? Yeah, you're our leading scorer. Yeah, you're our best player. But you know what? I'm a grown man. I can handle questions.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I thought it was extraordinarily disrespectful to Steven Adams. I thought it was completely inappropriate treatment of the reporter. You don't get to tell reporters. And again, you as a former reporter used to do that job, and still a journalist, obviously, and a sports writer, you know, for Russell Westbrook to dictate to the reporter what question he should ask. No, don't ask me that. Don't ask us that. You're trying to split us up. Ask me how come you struggled, Russell. How come you and the whole guys, not just how they struggled with that. Don't tell a reporter who's probably trying to write a column on here's the number disparity between when Russell's on the court and isn't, and here's what the guys who are on the court when he isn't there think about it and how they approach it and how they feel. It's probably a very legitimate sports column or article or report that this guy is trying to write. And if I'm Steven Adams, I'm a little bit PO'd that I'm not allowed to speak for myself there because Russell, who decides when I get to shoot, also decides when I get to speak. I just think it speaks very poorly of Russell Westbrook.
It could be, you know, but listen, in a perfect world, Bob, you know, you're going to want a situation where Adams articulates his point. But the reality is Adams knows the pecking order. He knows the score. This team revolves around Russell Westbrook. It is completely his team. He dominates everything about it on the court.
Now, which is why I don't like him. You know, that's why I don't like him. That's why I can't support him for MVP. You know, I mean, because he dominates every aspect of the team, including when the guys are allowed to talk and what they're allowed to talk about. I think it just shows why he will never get another superstar player to want to come and play with him. He's demonstrating on a daily basis why Durant wanted to get the hell away from him. Because he's so ball dominant, and he's so attention dominant. He cannot stand the idea that other guys get attention.
Yeah, that's a solid point. I mean, maybe Durant sits back and watches that clip, and he's kind of like, "See, told you."
No doubt.
You know, so yeah, I can't wait till Harden and the boys eliminate Westbrook, so we don't have to deal with him anymore.
And by the way, 5 for 14 or 18 was it in the second half? Big numbers, 35, 14, and 14. What did they mean? It means you packed them up in the first half. Second half, all you did was shoot. Nobody else got shots. And oh, by the way, while you were going 5 for 18 or whatever it was in the second half, and this is the part, Dennis, that really, really frustrates me with him and all of those who say he's the runaway winner for MVP. This is the problem that I have. Steven Adams in that game shot 8 for 10 from the floor. All right? He was 8 for 10. Victor Oladipo was 7 for 10. That's 80% and 70%. Russell Westbrook was 10 for 28. That's just a shade over 30%. Stop shooting so much. He's going to say, oh, but I had 14 assists. You had 14 assists in the first half when they really didn't mean as much. And when it came time to get the right shot in the fourth quarter and in the second half when you're getting beat by the Rockets and you need to get the ball to guys who are shooting it better than you are, hell, Robertson was 5 for 9, which is far better than Russell Westbrook. He's got a whole bunch of guys who shoot the ball better than he does on a somewhat consistent basis, and yet he's the one chucking 18 shots and making 4 of them.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine it would probably be difficult to be Westbrook's teammate as opposed to, for example, everything comes back to the King. With LeBron James, you know that even in crunch time, if he trusts you as a shooter and you've got a track record, he will pass the ball to you. and give up a potential drive or a potential, you know, shot in traffic, he'll get you the ball, even if you're not Kyrie. And so, you know, I just don't see that with Westbrook. I see these guys so deferential to him. They feel like, all right, in crunch time, we have to get the ball to Russell Westbrook every single time, or we're going to get screamed at, or we're going to get criticized. So I would think it would be uncomfortable to play with Russell Westbrook as opposed to playing with LeBron James.
Let's move on to one other subject. Dennis Manilov also, no, it's not from the Western Conference. I beg your pardon. This is the Celtics and Chicago Bulls series, which is now at two games apiece. Rajon Rondo's injury, of course, a huge, huge difference maker in that series. But something else that matters is the officiating, at least according to Fred Hoiberg, who said this about Isaiah Thomas.
Isaiah Thomas is a hell of a player, an unbelievable competitor. He's a warrior, everything he's going through right now. He had a hell of a game tonight. But when you're allowed to discontinue your dribble on every possession, he is impossible to guard. He's impossible to guard.
Yeah.
When you're able to put your hand underneath the ball and 100%. Take two or three steps and put it back down. It's impossible to guard him in those situations.
A lot of the great ball handlers.
100%.
Well, hold on.
Sorry about,
a lot of the great ball handlers in the NBA do that, of course. They turn the ball over. And a lot of them have a hesitation that allows them to look like they've picked up their dribble, and then they go ahead and put it back down again, and they're allowed to do so. But I think Hoiberg is right. I don't know that anybody does it as egregiously and as obviously as Isaiah Thomas. And you watch the film of him and the number of plays where he looks like he's stopped now. He's ready to take a jump or pass the ball. And then he puts it down and quick step past you. And you can't guard like that. That's Fred Hoiberg's stance, you say?
100% correct. You know, I know some people say, oh, it's whining. The guy just got punked twice in his own building. He's crying a river. Where was he when the Bulls were up 2-0 with the same complaint? It's just the reality. You make those complaints when you need the officials to recognize it. And I've been saying that for a long time about Isaiah Thomas. It is mind-blowing how he carries the ball. And here's the thing. What he's doing is it's a mechanism for him to create space because of his size disadvantage. I mean, yes, you give him a ton of credit for being an undersized, scorer, and an all-star caliber player at 5'9", but you also have to recognize that he's doing two things in my mind specifically to help him. One, he's initiating contact on his drives to try to draw a foul or to move a guy back so he has room to, you know, hook it over his head. And the other one, before that even, is the palming and the carrying. And what he does incredibly well and gets away with it is he carries in order to change direction, all right? he will take the ball, he'll be stepping left, he'll carry it and go to the right, and you say, oh, Isaiah Thomas, so quick, so, you know, agile and unbelievable how slippery he is. But when you look at it, the reason he slipped away is because he carried the ball right across the face. So I totally agree with Hoiberg. And this is, you know, Hoiberg's design is to try to get the officials to pay attention, because what he's hoping is one time early in a game, an official will make that call, and hopefully for Hoiberg's perspective, it'll plant a seed of doubt in Thomas's mind as to, am I allowed to do this anymore or continue to do this? And that will then affect how Thomas plays the game.
This is a legitimate question. And by the way, I agree with every word you said. You and I see eye to eye on this. Isaiah Thomas is a serial palmer, and it should not be allowed. However, this is also a legitimate question. When is the last time that you can remember a palming or carrying call in the NBA? I honest to God, and I watch it nightly, I don't recall the last time I saw them say, you know, blow the whistle and then make that gesture, you know, turning the hand over gesture that said you carried the ball. It's like the 3-4 steps in traveling. Very, very rarely does traveling ever get called, even on egregious ones. But palming, I think, is never called. And that's why he does it, and he's never been whistled for it. And it's probably, again, I think Kyrie does it somewhat. The best handler, Steph Curry, the best ball handlers in the world kind of do it. Maybe not as egregiously as Thomas, but I don't know that I've ever seen an official, or at least I can't remember the last time I have, seen him make that call. Can you?
Yeah, I saw Irvin get called for it once late in this season, and it was at the queue. And it was, you know, obviously surprising.
Was it really egregious? Well, do you remember the play? Did you say, yep, good call?
I suppose. I mean, yeah, I do remember the replay, and it looked like, yeah, you could have called that.
Okay.
But I, you know, I get the idea that everybody does it to a certain degree, especially when they're moving as fast as they do. I mean, James Harden, you could argue, does that type of thing, and he was also the one who, you know, invented the Euro step in this game, in my opinion, not invented it, but specialized in it. So you have various degrees of, you know, penalty, if you will, that isn't called. But I've always felt that Isaiah Thomas was egregious with the carrying, and that it would become an issue with the opposing team at some point. That's why I was not surprised when Hoiberg called it out, because I was watching the game yesterday, and I saw at least three or four times where I turned to the buddy I'm watching with, and I said, that's unbelievable what he just did, you know, in terms of the carry. So if I'm noticing it as just a fan of the NBA from Cleveland, Ohio, I can imagine that, you know, the team that's playing him in the postseason is 10 times more amplified and more, you know, in tune to that.
All right, Dennis, let's shift gears because I'm really out of time here, but I cannot let you go because the draft is Thursday without talking about this number one pick for the Browns. I won't even get into what they'll do with the 12 or trade up or whatever the case might be. I know you have said very clearly, Myles Garrett. I told you my opinion last time we talked about this, what I didn't like about thin-skinned Myles Garrett, who can't even handle criticism from interviewers. He wouldn't even do interviews because of that. I want to read to you, you probably have heard it already, but for those who are listening to us, Dennis, they may have not. Warren Sapp, Hall of Fame defensive lineman, about defensive lineman and prospective top pick, Myles Garrett, quote, "I don't see it from this kid. I see the splash plays, but everybody has those. Where's the game he took over? Where? Any defensive lineman who's the number one pick, you turn up and say, there it is. This kid, no, I don't. I'm a pretty plain and frank guy, and I watch the tape, and he disappears. I watch the tape, and he absolutely disappears. And here's one that's going to bite. I don't think this kid is as good as Courtney Brown either." We all remember the defensive end from Penn State who was their second number one overall pick after Tim Couch. And finally, he said about Garrett, "It's all about measurables. Once you hit the measurable, it's tough to get them old scout people off the numbers." And that's what he has. He's big and he's fast. Now some defensive line coach is thinking, I can turn him into something. How? I'm trying to figure this out. Really, are we lowering the bar? How do you respond to Warren Sapp and his thoughts of Myles Garrett as the number one pick?
Everyone's entitled to his or her opinion. I couldn't care less what comes out of Warren Sapp's pie hole. You know, I respect him as a great player in the NFL, but I also respect a ton of former players who do think that Myles Garrett is all that in a bag of chips and will be a very good NFL player. So to me, it doesn't make me shudder at all.
Do you get a lot of chance to watch tape, D-Man? Because I don't, so I don't know.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm not one of those guys like Dane Brugler or Matt Miller, one of those NFL draft scout guys.
No, I know. I just didn't know if you had been able to see more, because I'm trying to find out if Warren Sapp is right when he's, for anybody else who watches this stuff, you know, when he says, I watch tape and I don't see any of these games where he took over. I see the splash plays, but everybody can have a highlight reel. So right. I don't know if Sapp is onto something there, or if you've heard of other guys who have watched a lot of tape who have said, yeah, there's a lot to say, hey, how come he's not playing in this play? How come he is just not doing anything in this game, et cetera, et cetera? So I didn't know if you had seen it, because I have not.
No, I never played football at a high level, and obviously Sapp has forgotten more about football than I'll ever know.
And me too.
But what I go to, though, Bob, is, you know, I'm not just – I listen and read what many, many, many people have to say. And in the analysis of Garrett, I've read and heard from a lot of not only former NFL players, but NFL coaches, NFL evaluators who say this guy is legit. So if Warren Sapp was one of many who were casting doubt on Myles Garrett, okay, maybe that would make me pause. But, you know, in my mind, he's in the vast minority in terms of people who have laid eyes on Garrett. And also, if he didn't specify, from what I could see, as to what games he was watching. Because if he watched 2016 season, he probably saw a guy with a high ankle sprain who maybe wasn't going 100%, but at least he was out there for his team. So, you know, from all I've heard and read, the 2015 season, he was a monster. So I don't know exactly what Saf's referring to. But if I'm the Cleveland Browns, I let it go in one ear and out the other.
You know what's interesting is the one other prominent guy who is saying the same thing is also a former Tampa Bay Buccaneer defensive lineman, Booger McFarland. And that's the story I told you about last week. That's why he wouldn't do the interview with Mike and Mike, because Booger was in, and he didn't want to have to answer Booger's criticism, so he didn't do it. So Booger McFarland and Warren Sapp, coincidentally or not, both former Buccaneer linemen, on one of the great all-time defenses, too, by the way, that 2003 Tampa Bay Buccaneers defensive line that pretty much led them to the Super Bowl championship. So both of those guys not high at all on Myles Garrett. All right, D-Man, great stuff, basketball-wise and NFL analysis. We always appreciate it, brother. Have yourself a great day. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Thank you, Bob.
You got it. 4:45, let's get out now on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Good conversation with our friend Dennis. And tell you what. I was really, really surprised, Frank Argano, that he, as a former reporter, he used to be in those press conferences asking questions of the athletes. He's now a columnist and general sports writer out there in Cleveland. But as a guy who used to be in that, you know, I thought he would have taken particular offense, like so many other reporters, to Westbrook telling the reporter what he can and can't ask, and that Westbrook, he himself, decided to answer the question and wouldn't let Steven Adams do it. Maybe the guy was doing a story on the non-Westbrook players.
Right.
How do you feel about all of this when Westbrook isn't on the floor? And he actually kind of, for my money, he kind of ripped the reporter. I was surprised by that.
Yeah, I honestly, when I was, because I was looking at this story earlier today, and all that ran through my head was, God, I couldn't even imagine being that reporter. And I was so happy that the reporter actually stood his ground and said, no, I have the microphone.
Yeah.
I asked a question. You know, it's right there. If you read the media guidelines for the NBA, it's all set in stone. It's all written down that anybody can, any legitimate reporter can go to the press conference and their players are required to respond in some way instead of just saying next question.
Yeah.
And he didn't even ask Russell Westbrook. So, yeah, I was also surprised that D-Man went with that.
That's what was so frustrating about it.
Being in that position.
Yeah, that's what was so fresh. Now, if Steven Adams, sitting next to Russell Westbrook, had taken that question and decided, anything I say right now might not go well, because I might say, well, we're just not very good without him, or I might say, well, maybe the truth is because we don't get a lot of shot opportunities when he is on the floor, so when he's off, we're a little bit, you know, cold, and we're not sure what to do.
Right.
Anything I say, if Russell or Steven Adams had just said, no comment, I prefer not to talk about that right now, that's perfectly acceptable.
Yep. Absolutely.
That's an acceptable response, and the reporter would have had to go with that and say, okay, I respect that. But for Russell Westbrook to not even let him answer the question, and then to try to cut him off, next question, without, I thought it was very commendable that the reporter said, you know what, hey, hold on a second, I didn't ask you, I asked him, and I want to hear from him. If he wants to say no comment, then he can. But this, to me, is one of the reasons why I think so many people are frustrated with Russell Westbrook. Not only does he dominate these guys, you know, jobs, essentially, on the court by dictating what everybody does and how they do it, now he's dictating what they do off the court in the media and who can answer which questions and how they'll answer them based on his own personal point of view. And I found it just extraordinarily rude, disrespectful, and I was glad the reporter stood him up.
Right, and like you pointed out earlier, I mean, he did it to his own teammate, too. Let your teammate answer the question. He's a professional player. He's been to press conferences before. I mean, yeah, that's a tough question to answer, but, you know, you have to get used to being a little political and just kind of dancing around the question, so to speak, sometimes.
From the reporter's standpoint, it was a fair question, too. It was tough, but fair. It was a good question. Look, you're minus whatever the number is. When Russell goes to the bench, what goes on out there when Russell leaves? I believe that's how he framed the original question. Let me hear that again. Hold on a second.
Steven, second time in three games, you guys really struggled when Russell went to the bench. You were out there for part of that. What goes on when he goes to the bench? why is Houston so successful? And do you sense that they sort of get an energy boost just from him going out of the game?
Yeah, do the Rockets get an energy boost when he leaves? Do you feel like, oh, they're thinking this is the time we can seize upon the rest of these guys? What goes on out there when he leaves? That's such a very interesting question. I would love to know what Steven Adams says about that. I would love to know what Cantor or Robertson or anybody else says about that. Well, here's what happens when he's not there. We're a little bit confused about how to run it because he pretty much runs everything. He's the ball-dominant guy. Now, they wouldn't say it that way in a way to be critical, but the truth is that is a great question. What goes on when he's gone?
Yep.
How do you guys manage to decide who runs things and how to run things when Russell leaves the floor? Because he's maybe more so than anybody in the NBA, he is just so dominant and not in a great way. Dominant, of course, is a great thing to be as a dominating player, but not if it means dominating every facet of your teammates' existences. And that's where I think we'll have to leave this one. All right, really appreciate the conversation with Dennis Maniloff. Good calls, too, so let's do this all over again tomorrow, even better than we did it today. 3 o'clock, the next extravaganza, but stay where you are because drive time is coming up next right here on The Ticket.